yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080148, Regal Finance Company and Regal Finance Company 2 Limited versus Techstar Motors Inc. from Harris County in the 14th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 080169, Tangi Walters versus Cleveland Regional Medical Center, Shirley Kiefer and Keith Spooner, MD, from Harris County in the 1st Court of Appeals District. And docket number 080316, Methodist Healthcare System of San Antonio and others versus Emmeline Rankin from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we will take a brief recess after the first one. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the argument should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080148, Regal Finance Company versus Techstar Motors, Inc.
Mr. Post will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court.
I represent
the Regal Finance Companies, which are two Texas partnerships that paid $95 million to purchase car notes from Techstar Motors under a full recourse guarantee, lost $8 million when Techstar defaulted on that full recourse guarantee, recovered four of those $8 million in a judgment that was rendered now almost 5 years ago, and yet somehow stands before the court today
ordered to pay back to Techstar
$1 million out of the reserve funds that were held in escrow to guard against this precise risk. The Court of Appeals committed two distinct errors in reaching that conclusion, but I think that the errors are related because both the Court of Appeals' mishandling of the commercial reasonableness requirement under Article 9 and its decision with respect to the dealer reserve fund have the effect of unfairly enriching the party in breach of contract here and frustrate the reliance interests of secured creditors. And this is not the time to be undercutting creditor rights. So we submit that both of those decisions need to be reversed. And I'd like to suggest a roadmap for decision to the court this morning. I ask that you decide all the issues related to commercial reasonableness on the UCC claim. That means the question about the meaning of the relevant statute, the interpretation of the jury instruction, and the legal sufficiency challenge on the question of commercial reasonableness. All the other issues related to the Article 9 claim can be left for the Court of Appeals on remand.
Does that include who breached first?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that issue is even in debate here in the Supreme Court.
Well, it's mentioned in the brief and response and then never mentioned again.
I think that's right, Your Honor. It's referenced in the brief and response, but there was a question about which party committed the first material breach. Regal won the verdict on that question. And then, in addition, the Court of Appeals correctly held that there was, in fact, no breach under the express terms of the contracts by Regal, and therefore there was not even a material question to be decided about first material breach. I don't understand the respondent to have cross-petitioned and even brought that issue before the court, so I don't think that's a live issue.
So what are the issues that would remain after we decide commercial reasonableness for the Court of Appeals?
Your Honor, there are a range of alternative arguments that were pressed in the Court of Appeals by Techstar in opposition to our recovery on the Article 9 claim. They have to do with notice requirements, arguments about acceptance of collateral and satisfaction of these debts, some arguments about other aspects of the jury charge, other aspects of the damages. There's a whole host of issues. And of course, we're happy to have the court decide all those questions. You certainly have the McKelvey power to take up the Court of Appeals briefs, but we're respectful of the court's resources. And I think that the two issues that we have framed for the court are the two issues that are the most jurisprudentially important. I want to begin with the question of commercial reasonableness.
And the other one was, you didn't mention the other one because I interrupted you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The two issues are, number one, the question of commercial reasonableness under Article 9, and number two, the Court of Appeals mishandling of the dealer reserve accounts under the express contracts of these parties, and its failure to give effect to the terms of the contracts and this court's rule, as referenced in Fortune and other cases, that express contracts supersede any kind of unjust enrichment or quasi-contract claim. As I say, those two issues really are of a piece, because both of them result in enriching the party in breach and frustrating the reliance interests of the secured creditor. Let me begin then with the question of commercial reasonableness under Article 9 and the jury instruction. And I think it's helpful here to begin with what is not in dispute, because Techstar does not deny that the Court of Appeals' decision on this commercial reasonableness question is a novelty in American law. I think Techstar will not deny that the statute upon which the instruction was based is uniformly understood to be a safe harbor and not an obligation of a commercial secured creditor. Techstar will not deny that no American court has taken the view that the Court of Appeals took, that proof of that safe harbor was required to prove commercial reasonableness. And Techstar will not deny that it did not even take that position itself in the trial court, in closing argument, not even in the Court of Appeals.
What is commercial reasonableness here in the context of these facts?
Your Honor,
you have these cars that were sold and maybe they could have been auctioned or something different could have been done.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There is a debate about what would be the proper method, manner, and terms of resale of these repossessed vehicles. And Article 9 of the UCC sets out a general standard of commercial reasonableness, and it's Article 9.610B that sets forth the general rule. And it simply provides that the disposition of collateral must be commercially reasonable. And it leaves open for development on individual cases facts what constitutes commercial reasonableness.
But it's got to be more than that. This is what we did.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. It certainly would have to be more than this is what we do. But you have to provide evidence about, in the words of Article 9 and the words of the first sentence in the jury instruction here,
evidence about the method, manner, time, place, and other terms of the disposition.
And then all of the authorities under Article 9 recognize that there's then a balancing about the totality of those facts to determine whether this was reasonable. Remember that the UCC was intended to get away from technical legal rules under ancient common law doctrines and to bring the idea of commercial reasonableness into the forefront of commercial law. And so there are no strict bright line rules here. It's a matter of taking into account the totality of all the circumstances. And in this case, the jury heard extensive evidence about the practices by which Regal undertook to dispose of these vehicles, had all the loan files from every one of these vehicles before it to consider whether that was commercially reasonable.
Does the jury instruction itself create a problem?
No, I think
not, Your Honor. And in fact, let me turn precisely to that question, because the jury instruction is framed explicitly in the terms of Article 9 itself. The first sentence of the jury instruction is taken from the general rule in Section 9.610B. The second sentence of the jury instruction submits one of the three safe harbors that Article 9 recognizes will be sufficient in and of themselves to constitute commercial reasonableness. The Court of Appeals has simply misread that language to suggest that it creates a mandatory burden of proof rather than one manner of proving commercial reasonableness. And that's erroneous for two distinct reasons.
But what aspect of the jury charge defines reasonableness other than in the dealer context?
Your Honor, I think the jury charge does not define reasonableness at all. If you look in this very set of instructions in question one, there is a definition of good faith. The instruction says good faith means X, but it doesn't define reasonableness.
But isn't that the problem? Because I can understand how in the context of the entire statute it looks like a safe harbor provision, but if it's the only standard that's given to the jury and there is no other standard, then how does it become a safe harbor?
Well, Your Honor, I think two reasons here. First, understanding that language, that commercial reasonableness exists if certain facts are established, misunderstands the plain meaning of the word if. That's just a mishandling of the technical meaning of the word if in American grammar and logic. But I would say even more important, this is exactly the language that Article 9 itself uses. On page 12 of the reply brief, I provide you both the statutory language and the charge language.
Let me grant you, let's say it's a safe harbor. Let's just take that reading at face value. If the only definition they have of commercial reasonableness is the safe harbor provision, then why aren't they held to that standard?
But, Your Honor, it's not a definition, and it's certainly not the only definition. The first sentence of that instruction says, all aspects of disposition must be commercially reasonable. The second sentence does not purport to define commercial reasonableness. It simply says that a certain set of facts, that is, compliance with dealer practices, will be commercially reasonable. And I think on this point, it is really important to recognize that you cannot divorce the statute from the instruction. The language of this instruction, particularly the critical word that the Court of Appeals focuses on, the word if, is taken verbatim from the statute. The court tells us consistently, statutory questions are to be submitted in the language of the statute. There's a reason for that rule. The reason is that we want the rights of Texans to be governed by the rules that the legislature has enacted. And here, it's an even more powerful policy because we're talking about a uniform act that has been given uniform nationwide application.
Isn't this the kind of case where you really don't need a definition of commercial reasonableness? Individual jurors sell and buy cars all the time, walk
absolutely
on used car lots, et cetera. Let me ask, the way it was submitted, there were 906 or 60 years.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Were they each individually submitted?
No, that's
the contracts. I mean, what was that checklist? Sometimes the jury said good faith,
sure.
Sometimes not.
Sure. There are two separate submissions that relate to the commercial reasonableness issues because the Regal partnerships have affirmative claims for the deficiency judgment under Article 9. Techstar was asserting its own claims for statutory penalties. Techstar submitted all of those special issues at the end of the charge in order to try and establish its statutory penalty claims. Our Article 9 deficiency claim was submitted in Question 6 and instructed the jury correctly. You award damages only for those vehicles for which Regal carried its burden of establishing commercial reasonableness. And then the jury was able to look at all the evidence, look at all the vehicles, and return a verdict that took into account that requirement. And in fact, the jury returned only $4 million in damages of the $8 million of out-of-pocket losses that Regal had suffered. So really, the technical answer to the court's question is that those are two completely separate series of submissions. The final special issues don't relate to our deficiency claim.
Okay, then with respect to question six, if the jury was determined damages only for those vehicles that there was a commercially reasonable transaction, why would you be entitled to $750,000 from the dealer's reserve fund in addition to that?
I think that's a fair point, Your Honor, and I think that the correct disposition of that would be to provide the dealer reserve fund assets, which are held in reserve to guard against the risk of defaults, should be provided as an offset to any recovery by Regal. That is, we hold that money in escrow. It's intended to guard against the risk of defaults, and it would be appropriate to say that is an offset against our losses. It's not appropriate to say that we do not recover for the $8 million in losses and we pay out the $1 million that was held in reserve. And let me turn to that issue because I think it is an important question in its own right.
Do you think it's a credit against the $4 million or not?
I think it should be credited against the $4 million, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
Quick question. What do you make of the comment to the UCC, to that provision, and what measure of sort of deference should we give that?
Safe harbor?
Yes.
Your Honor, I think the comment itself makes explicit that these three manners of proving commercial reasonableness are, quote, neither required nor exclusive. And that comment has, I think, decisive impact because the comments to the UCC are intended to guide a uniform national application of this statute. And in fact, the White and Summers treatise and all of the authorities that construe it recognize that comment signals unequivocally that provision is simply a safe harbor. It's not a burden of proof. So with respect then, Your Honor, to the reserve funds, there's, I think, one ultimate fact that's important for the court to understand. At the time Techstar repudiated its obligations under the party's contracts, there were $20 million worth of car notes that were outstanding that Regal was servicing. The parties had agreed that Regal could maintain reserves to guard against the risk of default. That's what this $975,000 at issue represents. Techstars' position here in the Court of Appeals decision is to say not only does Regal not require its out-of-pocket losses, but it has to surrender the very reserves that were intended to guard against those losses. And that's simply contrary to the contracts that structure the parties' relationships and, of course, this Court's rule in Fortune and other cases about the express contract rule. Let me take you through, I think, the three essential aspects of this argument. First, there's no controversy here that the purchase-sale agreements, the express contracts between Techstar and Regal, provide for the holdback reserve and provide unequivocally in paragraph 8 that all reserve accounts can be held by Regal until all the car notes are liquidated. Only then can any remaining balance be returned to Techstar. Number two, the Bank One loan agreement, in which the parties expanded their credit facility and provided Techstar with a greater opportunity to sell vehicles, required that dealer reserve fund to be expanded to 5% of the outstanding car notes that Regal had purchased. And in paragraph 5.2p, that 5% requirement is set forth in the contract. And importantly, in paragraph 1.23, the dealer reserve fund set forth by the Bank One loan agreement is defined explicitly in terms of the reserve account that is created by the PSAs. So, as a matter of law, these two contracts establish the reserve account created by the contracts between Techstar and Regal is the very reserve account that Bank One required to be increased. And then critically, in question one, this jury found that Techstar agreed to maintain that reserve account at the 5% level because it allowed Techstar's principals to avoid personal liability. It allowed Techstar to increase its own business and to take the benefits of the Bank One loan agreement. With that comes the burden of the requirement that the reserve funds be used for the purpose for which they are intended. And so the Court of Appeals decision here really turns the express contract rule and these parties' contracts upside down.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Wilshire will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the Court, my name is Gene Wilshire. I have the honor to represent Techstar here this morning. Let me just start out by saying that I think we may be getting the cart before the horse when we start talking about definitions in the charge and parsing the Court of Appeals approval. I think the fundamental issue here is whether or not there is any evidence of commercially reasonable disposition in this case, irrespective of how you define or parse the charge. Now, we are told, they admit, what happened in this case was this. With no expert testimony, no explanation of the market, and please understand that we're talking about the used car wholesale car and truck and utility vehicle market. But
why would expert testimony be necessary?
Sir?
Why would expert testimony be necessary in this type of transaction? Why couldn't they just bring somebody in with experience of disposing of these type of vehicles?
If he comes in and he testifies on the basis of his experience in disposing of those vehicles and testifies as to the reasonableness of the disposition, I would submit that's expert testimony.
Did you bring someone else to counter that testimony? Couldn't you bring your own expert?
There was no testimony such as that in this record at all. There is absolutely no statement by any person, expert or otherwise, that the procedures that Regal was using are calculated in any way if followed.
There's no testimony by James Wright as to how these cars were disposed of.
As to how they were disposed of under, no, that's not technically correct. And what he said was, here are our procedures. Never did he say, as to any one of the 906 vehicles at issue, that these procedures were applied in this manner to this procedure.
Well, he wasn't allowed to. Why couldn't a jury? Okay, he's testifying. I've been in this business for almost 30 years. and I've handled repossessions, and here is how I handled these. You get bids if you can, you know, at least two bids per vehicle after having gone through and done an assessment of them, and then you put them up for sale. Why couldn't a jury say, well, that is a reasonable procedure? How else are you going to sell, you know, a car that's been repossessed? It's going to have all kinds of problems on the wholesale market. Why isn't that enough in terms of testimony to support a jury's determination that it's commercially reasonable?
Because he never even testified, Your Honor, that this is the way he'd done it in the past. He just said, I've been doing it for 30 years, and here's the procedures that we put in effect here. And he was not allowed, specifically not allowed, to testify that that met any industry standard.
Okay, so the jury says, I've got no information about industry standards, but I'm listening to this guy who says, I take bids on these cars after having refurbished them if I can and put them out for sale as is. Why can't a jury say that is a reasonable approach to selling old cars?
Well, because the cases tell us all of the factors that go into determining commercial reasonableness. Was there advertising? Should the vehicles have been refurbished? Should the vehicles have been sold at auction? Should the vehicles have been put out to retail, put on consignment? Any and all of that. Nothing was discussed. And what's important here is that it was their burden to show that with respect to 906 individual dispositions, each and every one of those was reasonable.
But why couldn't you just have an instruction that said, just hypothetically, were these sales commercially reasonable, period? Here's the file. You look at it and look at the file and see if you think it was commercially reasonable, because they seem to parse through to some extent.
The files contain various, they're all thick. I mean, that we actually had to vacate the jury room so that the jury could have the entire courtroom to look at these files. For example, the jury was, every file was supposed to have a NADA sheet in it according to their procedures. All of them didn't, but that was the procedures. Now, how is a jury supposed to know, without any testimony whatsoever, that when they look at that NADA sheet, and there's a number there for loan value, that they're supposed to know that that is a NADA wholesale value? Nobody told them that. And then when you look at the totality of what happened here, it's just astonishing.
But the totality is kind of what bothers me, because you said go sell your own cars, and then you don't like the way they sold them, and there seems like TechStar sort of made its bed in this case.
Didn't do that is because under the purchase and sale agreements, they were required to refund us $2,000 every time we paid them. And even after we got sued, TechStar continued to make these people whole 100% for 3 months. And then when it reached $750,000 in unreturned money on the purchase agreement, we're supposed to get $2,000 every time we repurchase a contract. And historically, that's really important, because the evidence is undisputed that when TechStar was handling these repossessions, its average loss was about approximately $1,600 a vehicle before application of the $2,000 when it disposed of them. But when Regal had it, the average loss is $9,750 a car. Absolutely no explanation to the jury as to how something this bad can happen.
Mr. Wilshire, let me ask you a second.
Sure.
Were there interrogatories and discovery about expert witnesses and cutoff dates and things of that nature?
Yes, Your Honor.
And no one was designated as an expert witness?
That is correct. At trial, and it is in the record, after Mr. Wright had been put on the stand, first of all, after my motion in limine to exclude any expert testimony because there had been no one designated, which was granted, of course, then they made Mr. Wright's testimony split over 2 days. They came back before his second day of testimony and made a motion to allow him to testify as an expert and to tell the jury that these procedures are calculated to be adequate. And the judge appropriately denied that. So there was no expert testimony. We've set out, there's a couple of things that that we need to talk about, though. The one interesting thing about this charge is the charge didn't ask the jury which vehicles were disposed of in a commercially reasonable manner, which is what the UCC says. Rather, it asked the jury only those that were sold in a commercially reasonable manner. And as you can figure out from the attachments to our brief, there were 339 of these vehicles that weren't sold at a deficiency sale. 41 of them were not resold at all. And the other ones were those in which Regal elected to retain the vehicles in lieu of the obligation and the deficiency. Right? And so there's no deficiency sale there. So the charge is really messed up at that point. And that's what happens, and that's why I think the Court of Appeals reading of this particular charge is correct.
Did you object to the charge on that basis?
We objected to the charge issuing it globally, and I disagree with counsel. We tendered the individual 906 vehicles individually to get a granulated finding on every car. But that was denied, but it was allowed on questions of penalties.
Is that the only way you think it would have been proper to
I do, Your Honor. Since it says every disposition, I don't know any other way to do it, and we certainly showed it could be done because the jury did it.
What about having like a bellwether trial, getting
a
bellwether trial, getting a random sampling of the vehicles that were disposed of and find out if the method it was reasonable?
I think that if they had offered that evidence, it might well, whether with an appropriate expert, it might well have come in. But there is no such evidence, and no such attempt was made.
You requested additional instructions on what commercially reasonable means, and
yes, we did.
Regal objected to them.
Yes,
they were not
yes,
submitted.
They did.
What were they? What in general?
You know. Basically, we took it out of the Havens case, which everybody has cited, in which they listed the factors to be considered as to whether time, place, motive were, and the court denied that over Regal's objection, so that the jury was not given guidance as to exactly what they should have examined in order to determine if a sale is commercially reasonable as to time, place, mode of disposition, etc. The five factors that are found in the UCC. Here's what I think is important about the fact that the charge asks those that are sold, because it's been, as everybody admits, the only definition of sale is, it says a sale is commercially reasonable if you meet the safe harbor of doing it in the manner in which the industry accepts. And nowhere is the jury told that, you know, now and remember, even though we said sale is a disposition, that's not in the charge, and that's why I think the Court of Appeals read this particular charge the only way it can be fairly read, and that is that there is a definition of commercially reasonableness for the purposes of this charge, and here it is. You've got to meet the uniform standards. But again, I come back to the fundamental issue that just brings me right back to where I start every time. Without somebody who has some knowledge and expertise telling this jury that what we do is calculated to lead to a commercially reasonable disposition, how can a jury then just take a pile of paper, every file of which has different matters in it, and as lay people say, well, this is commercially reasonable and that one's not? I do not believe that's possible. And therefore, I think in the absence of some guidance to give the jury some nexus between these procedures and how they analyze the files, there is no evidence.
If James Wright had been designated as an expert, would you have objected to that designation with his 30
yes,
years?
Yes, I would, on the basis years, that, I'm sorry, Your Honor, didn't mean.
With his 30 years of experience in the business?
I would have. I deposed Mr. Wright. His 30 years experience in the business bore very little on this particular types of dispositions. He had been primarily in management in dealerships, and then he had been a wholesaler himself, but he had never, to my knowledge, been involved. And furthermore, I would have objected because
he'd been involved in what?
he had very little experience, as I recall, in disposing of collateral.
I thought he did it for Techstar himself.
No.
Techstar purchased, I think it was four vehicles over a 10-year period that he brought to them as a wholesaler. He did not do any selling for Techstar at all. He never had a position with Techstar. And what's even more importantly,
but he sold to more than 30 different wholesalers, and Techstar bought some of those cars when he sold them wholesale.
No, he was an independent wholesaler, Your Honor. So he would go out and find a car, and he would bring it to Techstar and say, are you interested in this car? And if they were, they bought it. That was not their primary way. It wasn't even where they got 99% of their cars. They had in-house wholesalers who procured vehicles for them.
When Techstar left this arrangement, was that a breach of a contract? When they sent that letter that said we're no longer going to continue this transaction with Regal, was that a breach?
We certainly thought it was not, and I certainly don't think it was, because we'd already gone 3 months without being allowed to get our $2,000 each time we tendered 100% on the dollar and repurchased a contract at face value. We were at that point down $750,000 in cash flow. We had been funding every one of those $2,000 we were supposed to get out of regular cash flows, even though that was the money that was being held was ours. So yes, I disagree with that, but the one point that I think needs to be...
I've asked the other side, you mentioned in the brief and response that there's an issue on who breached first, but that I don't find it argued in the brief. So is that an issue, do you think, before us or not?
I do not believe it is, Your Honor. I read that as background.
Okay. Thanks.
Let me just ask you real quick, back to the commercial reasonableness argument. Do you think that the Court of Appeals was wrong in not treating that as a safe harbor provision? And I'd particularly like for you to say a word about the amicus brief that was filed in the Court of Appeals by Mr. White.
Well, I think the amicus brief did not comment on the second opinion. But the amicus brief talks about, says that this is going to be precedent for saying that you always have to meet the safe harbor. And respectfully, neither the first opinion nor the second ever said that. They just said that under this charge, this is the way it has to be.
But that's pretty much what they said, because they said this charge, the if language, means shall.
But they did not say you couldn't write the charge appropriately in the precise form of the UCC. And so I don't think it does. I think this is just a case where there isn't any evidence of commercially reasonable disposition. But if I may, I need to comment quickly on the money had and received matter. The concept that the agreement that the jury found that Techstar agreed to fund an obligation of Regal. Regal had an obligation to Bank One to maintain Regal funds at a 5% level of principal. That was,
see how that was any different than the holdback account?
Absolutely different.
Were there two account numbers?
There were
750 and then there was a 5% and there were two different numbers?
No.
Different check statements?
They were handled two different ways completely. The 750 per vehicle was withheld from every purchase that Regal ever made. On the other hand, the Bank One reserve was funded out of pocket by Techstar. In other words,
but it all went in the same account.
It was all held under the same number, but it was not funded in the same way. They would simply give Regal money to put up at the bank to say that they had the reserve there, funded in two totally different ideas. And until we got to time to enter judgment, Regal never contended. In fact, they said repeatedly through the discovery, and they pled it this way, that there was a separate standalone agreement to fund the Bank One Reserve. And there's nothing in Special Issue Number 1 to suggest that the jury was asked if the PSAs had been amended. And contrary to what my...
But it seems to me, if you're correct, there should have been an account with $750 per vehicle in it, and another account with 5% of the outstanding loan balances in it. And then that would add up to a whole lot more than 5%.
No, it didn't work that way in practice. But again, we had no control of how Regal kept their books or how they reported to Bank One.
But just so I'll be clear, the $750 per vehicle was part of the 5%.
No.
It was all put in,
but ultimately the only thing left at the end of the day was the money that Techstar had put in to fund the 5%.
Well, I guess I'm still confused. Was it ever more than 5%?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I believe it was from time to time.
But it would have been a whole lot more than 5% if it had been $750 per vehicle and 5%.
Yes. But I apologize. I'd have to go back and look at the statements to answer that question precisely. But I don't think we really even need to get to that issue. Fortune says that if you're going to rely on an express contract to avoid an obligation, to avoid a money hadn't received, you got to plead it. And there is absolutely no pleading that ever invoked the express contract exception, which under Fortune and several other cases, including the recent Tricon case out of the 14th Court of Appeals, says you got to plead it, you got to prove it, and you got to get a jury finding on it. They didn't plead it, they didn't prove it, and they didn't get a jury finding on it. And their trial pleading, their trial answer can be found at the clerk's record at 1491, and you will not see any pleading whatsoever with respect to express contract, which is under Fortune, and under every case that's followed an affirmative defense. It has to be pled, has to be proven, and you have to get a finding. Finally, Your Honor, just by way of summing up, I just reiterate that I think it's important to note that the underlying issue here, no matter how you parse the charge, is whether or not there's any evidence of commercially reasonable disposition. I suggest to the court that when all you do is hand a group of lay people thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of pieces of paper, and then tell them, well, here's what we tried to do, not what we did. This is what we tried to do, without any showing that you have not done so. And I also suggest that we are entitled to our money on the Techstar's entitled to his money on hadn't received. I thank the court for the time and pray that the Court of Appeals be affirmed.
Out of curiosity, how long was the jury out?
5 days.
Gosh.
Thank you, Mr. Wilshire.
Let me begin, I think, by resolving any uncertainty about the money hadn't received, because Justice Hecht, I think your question focuses on really the central issue. There were not two separate accounts. The financial statements make very plain all of these reserves were aggregated in a single dealer reserve.
What difference does that make if they're not in control of it, though?
Well, Your Honor,
you're in control and the bank's in control, and that's your deal with the bank.
But the difference, Your Honor, that it makes is that it validates the testimony of our principal, Mr. McMillan, and the jury's finding that Techstar agreed to fund this dealer reserve account, and as the contracts themselves make plain, it's all the same account, and all the money was accounted for as the same account. You can look at the financial statements, which are, I think, plaintiff's exhibits 59 and 64, and you can look at Mr. McMillan's testimony in volume 3 of the record at pages 206 to 209, where he explains that Mr. McInvale, on behalf of Techstar, agreed to fund this obligation. It did not change the practices with respect to the way the dealer reserve account was handled. It simply increased the holdback from $750 per car to 5% total. And so to meet that 5% obligation, the parties would make transfers in order to maintain the reserve account at that required level from time to time.
Let me be clear. Was Techstar a party to the agreement between Regal and Bank One?
Your Honor, Techstar is not technically the party, although it is important to know that Techstar and Mr. McInvale acknowledges the agreement because they have to give guarantees.
Did Techstar sign the agreement between Bank One and Regal?
The Techstar principal, Mr. McInvale, did sign it in the context of acknowledging it and acknowledging his guarantee. I understand the court's...
So his, are you saying his signature line merely said acknowledgement as opposed to party?
I think that's right, Your Honor. I want to say he acknowledges and is fully aware of the terms of that agreement, including its definition of the dealer reserve account. Techstar is not the obligor, but that's why the answer to question one is so critical, because in question one, the jury found that Techstar made the agreement to maintain that dealer reserve fund. That finding has not been set aside. The suggestion here today that there was some defect in the pleadings, I think, is not sustainable. We pled unequivocally the existence of a contract, which is all we were required to plead, and we proved it.
Let me go back and deal a little bit more with my question. If Techstar were a party to the agreement, I'd know what that means.
Right.
You're obligated to do what it says and pay what it says, and
right,
et cetera. What does it mean when Techstar acknowledged the agreement?
What it means, Your Honor, is simply I don't want there to be any misunderstanding that Techstar and its principals were strangers to this agreement and had no idea that the agreement was requiring that the dealer reserve fund be increased. And then when the jury finds in question one that Techstar agreed to maintain the fund at that 5% level, you have all the findings that Fortune requires in order to establish the express contract defense. Remember, Fortune says if the subject matter of the claim is covered by an express contract, then a quasi-contract claim is barred.
What evidence in the record supports the judgment? What,
with respect to commercial reasonableness, Your Honor?
Right.
Your Honor, I think that the court's alluded to the testimony of Mr. Wright, who talked about all of the facts and circumstances under the general rule, method, manner, time, places, and other terms of the disposition. Also the testimony of Kent McMillan, who testified about the manner of disposition. In that respect, I think it's important to pick up on Justice Heck's question about the difficult circumstances in which Regal found itself. Remember that Regal had no experience in repossessing and reselling vehicles. Regal had no infrastructure. Regal had no retail sales license.
Excuse me, and let me interrupt you right there. So how did Regal know what was commercially reasonable in how to dispose this if they had no experience? Did they have to find someone who knew what commercially reasonable was?
Regal retained Mr. Wright with his 30 years of experience.
My question is, did they have to find someone who knew what commercially reasonable was?
Your Honor, I think that they need to act in a commercially reasonable way.
Well,
and
how do they know what that was?
I think that there's not any single pure concept of commercial reasonableness where you can say there's an individual out here who knows, quote, what commercial reasonableness is. What the White and Summers treatise indicates is that the real litmus test here is whether the secured creditor acted in good faith in trying to get full value. What Regal did was to retain as its agent a gentleman with 30 years of experience in this field who did the best he could
Let me just ask you real quick. I think I heard Mr. Wilshire throw out a number of something like the average vehicle deficiency was $9,000 under Regal sales. Did I hear that right?
Your Honor, I'm not certain that I can validate or invalidate that number, but I think what is really critical is to remember these are the circumstances that creditors find themselves in. But
if that were right, and the average deficiency when Techstar was selling them was around $1,600, that's a pretty big difference.
That might be a big number, but this is exactly what Professor White talks about in the chapter of White and Summers that we've appended to the brief. Reasoning backwards from a low price is inappropriate. You have to take into account the circumstances in which a creditor finds itself and to determine whether the procedures that have been undertaken are a good faith effort to maximize the value of the collateral. I don't want to dignify that assertion as being correct because I'm not certain that we would agree that that's true, but I think the more important
Wright and Summers does say price is very important. In fact, it says to realize a satisfactory price is the reason and the only reason why we force the secured creditor to do a commercially reasonable sale. So
that's correct,
validating or invalidating that price differential might be important.
Your Honor, without question, price is one factor to be taken into the equation. And when you read the White and Summer chapter, White and Summer makes clear price is one of the variables. We all understand it's the ultimate objective. But the question is whether the procedures have been commercially reasonable, not whether the ultimate price is right, because that's simply not fair to the secured creditor.
But one will bear on the other, won't it?
You're right. And that is a factor that the jury takes into account, and this jury awarded only 50% of the damages.
What evidence was there that these procedures that Mr. Wright used were commercially reasonable?
Well, Your Honor, there is not a excerpt that I can give you in which anyone intoned a magic word that said, I bless these procedures as commercially reasonable. That's not what the UCC requires. As our brief sets out, there's extensive evidence about the circumstances under which Regal disposed of the vehicles, how they disposed of the vehicles, and there's testimony from Mr. Wright about his practices on this lot under these circumstances in the context of his experience. The jury is allowed to draw the conclusion of the ultimate fact from that evidence. I think that's exactly what the drafters of the UCC always contemplated with the requirement of commercial reasonableness.
So your position is that this is one of those matters that a reasonable, ordinary juror knows.
Absolutely.
Without being told.
Absolutely.
This is not like a physician saying a reasonable standard of care is X.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Let me give the court just one final illustration at this point. The fight over what type of magic language might be required is really illustrated. Volume 6 of the record, at pages 103 to 106, you'll see a series of objections where Techstar's counsel is trying to say Mr. Wright could not testify about whether cars that were in a deteriorated condition, that were damaged and in bad repair, had lower value. He said, that's expert testimony. That testimony can't be offered. Respectfully, that's insane. Any lay juror can draw that conclusion. The lay jurors could draw just the conclusions that the evidence put before them allowed them to draw, and they drew it over the course of 5 days very fairly.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.